The following content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, enjoy articles to help you improve your green thumb. And now, here's NCRS volunteer Cindy Fowler.
We'll start with the Raleigh News and Observer. Some questions and answers by Jessica Damiano. Question. I've had these plants for many years. All of a sudden, over the last 6 months or so, some of the leaves have yellowed and browned and died. I water weekly and do very little else, and they have always thrived. Have I started doing something wrong? Answer. Overwatering often is to blame when leaves of pothos, also known as devil's ivy, turn yellow and brown. The plants thrive best when the soil they are growing in is allowed to dry between waterings, and too much water will result in a fungal disease, often referred to as root rot. Keeping my plant on a set watering schedule, say, once a week, is not ideal because conditions change throughout the year. During winter, indoor heating dries the air and may mean plants need more water. However, most house plants do slow down during this time as sunlight is reduced. Timing is delicate because allowing soil to become too dry will result in a wilted, stressed plant and potentially some tissue damage. It's best to plunge your finger into the soil and feel for yourself whether the root area is dry. Remove affected leaves, water only when the soil is slightly dry, and resume fertilizing with 10-10-10 or 20-20-20 product now that spring has arrived. Question. I have two peace lily plants, one slightly smaller than the other. The leaf tips of the larger plant show many brown, frayed edges, while the other smaller plant has just a few frayed edges. They both get indirect sunlight, and I water them generally every 2 weeks. I've had both plants for about 7 or so years. What am I doing wrong? Answer. One reason spathiphyllum leaf tips turn brown is overexposure to sunlight, which doesn't seem to be the case, as you've noticed that your peace lilies are growing in indirect light. This also can occur when plants are over or underwatered. But if you've had them on the same watering schedule for 7 years and you have not moved or altered their growing conditions, my guess is they are succumbing to a buildup of minerals. Minerals, such as calcium, are present in tap water and over time can accumulate around plant roots, causing distress and inhibiting them from properly performing their functions. Check the pot's drainage holes. If you see a white residue, then you can be sure mineral deposits are contributing to your plant's decline. However, an absence of this visual clue does not necessarily mean buildup around roots is not to blame. Using sharp scissors, trim away brown edges, cutting about 1/8 of an inch into the healthy part of the leaves. Next, place pots in the sink and flush the soil with plenty of bottled water until it drains freely from the bottom. Going forward, watering exclusively with bottled water should resolve the problem. Now from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter. Dandelion by Barbara Pleasant. Dandelion is a perennial weed with a strong taproot that can make itself at home almost anywhere. Young leaves gathered in spring are edible. Most young weeds can be pulled from the soil. They will slide out most easily if you pull them when the soil is wet. Getting the root up is crucial. The main stem is the root's handle. Grasp it as close to the soil line as you can. If the weeds are breaking off at the crown as you pull up, slip a kitchen fork, dandelion weeder, or a similar tool under the weed. Pry and twist as you pull up. Weeds that have tap roots usually must be pried out. A flexible pair of waterproof gloves will keep your hands comfortable as you weed. And it's good to have a nice sitting pad, too. Let pulled weeds bake in the sun a day or so before composting them. If pulled weeds are holding mature seeds, compost them separately in a hot, moist pile before using this compost in the garden. Weeds that regrow from persistent roots must be dug. Use a spade or digging fork to dig spreading perennials such as bindweed, Canada thistle, and quack grass. Start digging a foot away from the plant's center to loosen the soil. Then, lift the weed from beneath, which reduces how many root pieces are likely to break off and regrow. Dandelion and other weeds that grow from persistent taproots can be dug the same way, or you can use a dandelion weeder to pry them up. In places where digging dandelions is not practical, use a sharp knife to slice off the leaves and the top inch or two of taproot at a diagonal angle. There are several herbicides made from natural ingredients. Those that contain clove oil, eugenol, give the best control of young broadleaf weeds. Products containing acetic acid, often in combination with citric acid, do a good job on young grasses. Some products contain both clove oil and acetic acid, so are useful for a broad variety of weeds. Soap-based herbicides dehydrate leaves. All of these types of organic herbicides work best on young weeds. To minimize damage to neighboring plants, spray only in dry, still weather. To maximize effectiveness, spray young weeds when temperatures are above 70 degrees Fahrenheit and the sun is shining brightly. Most weeds reproduce primarily from seeds, and the seeds of some can remain viable when buried in the soil for decades. It's essential to keep weeds from shedding seeds in the garden. Garden weeds, neglected until they reach seed-bearing age, can be lopped off near the soil line with pruning shears, a stout knife, or a string trimmer with a blade attachment. Cutting back perennial weeds again and again reduces reseeding and also forces the plant to use up food reserves stored in their roots. In a garden that has gone hopelessly weedy, mowing it down promptly, raking out seed-bearing debris, and starting over next year is a big step in the right direction. Mowing regularly helps keep weeds under control in lawns. When mowing where seed-bearing weeds are present, collect the clippings in a bagger and dispose of them in a shady place. Now, Drought-Tolerant Annuals by Ellen Zakos. No matter where you live, water is a precious resource. Some of us need to conserve more actively than others, but none of us would willingly waste water. So why not plant drought-tolerant flowering annuals? In addition to saving on your water bill, you'll spend less time on garden maintenance. And that's welcome news for every busy gardener. Here are five excellent annuals that thrive in dry growing conditions. Spider flower, cleome. Cleome is an excellent annual for the back of a sunny border or a wildflower meadow. In a few short months, this annual can grow 4 to 5 feet tall and 2 feet wide. Stems branch without pinching and may need to be staked as they get larger. Cleomes are sun lovers and grow best with at least 6 hours of direct sun. Blooms may be white, pink, lavender, and magenta. In too moist soils, foliage will turn yellow and the plants will not thrive. Ice plant. Technically, this succulent is a perennial, but depending on your USDA hardiness zone, you may use it like an annual, like I do. Daisy-shaped flowers come in yellow, white, and magenta. Ice plant foliage is narrow, smooth, succulent, and grayish-green. Some varieties spread to provide excellent ground cover, while others are more clumping. They grow best in sandy soils and full sun, and do well both in containers and in the ground. Licorice plant, curry plant. Licorice plant comes in several shapes and colors, and all of them are drought tolerant. Its leaves and stems are woolly. This is a common trait on drought-tolerant plants, as the hairs on the plant slow the evaporation of water from leaf tissue. Licorice plant is usually grown for its foliage rather than its small yellow flowers. Leaves may be gray-blue, chartreuse, or multicolored. Licorice plant grows well in sandy to average soils. It is a sun lover and may get leggy if it does not receive enough light. Pinch the growing tips to encourage branching. Lantana. Lantana gives so much and asks so little. 4-inch pots planted in May are the size of small shrubs by August. Lantana tolerates poor soils and blooms best in full sun. Its flowers are irresistible to butterflies. Flowers may be pastel, lavender, cream, vibrant, yellow or vermilion, or multicolored. This plant will bloom steadily and prolifically until frost, whether you deadhead or not. Most lantanas are upright growers with stiff branching stems, but Lantana montevidensis has a weeping growth habit. And finally, moss rose. Moss rose is a showy ground cover with flowers in orange, yellow, white, and magenta. Blooms may be single or double. Its leaves and stems are fleshy and succulent. Purslane is an excellent choice for containers and the front of a sunny border. Full sun and sandy soils are best, but purslane will grow in any garden soil that's not heavy clay. Deadheading will tidy up the plant, but is not necessary for continuous bloom. Even drought-tolerant plants need a little extra water when they're getting established. So don't just plant and run. Water well once a week while your annuals are settling in. Then watch for signs of wilt as the summer progresses. Depending on where you live and how much rainfall you get, these annuals may need very little supplemental water for the rest of the season. And now, from the Triangle Gardener magazine. This article is by Kit Flynn. Growing a Realistic Garden. The other day, I found myself throwing several gardening magazines down in disgust, equating them to the fashion and food porn we see every day, where hipless models serve as clothes hangers and where pictured tomatoes are without blemish. What, you ask, is my problem with these? I have to believe that these pictures are fake, that the photographed garden has been primped and pampered for the occasion. Look closely. Where are the flopping plants? Where are the inevitable spaces in the perennial border? Where are the plants crying for deadheading? Am I the only gardener who suffers from drooping plants? As I have often said, I am an untalented plant staker. Some people can stake plants in a highly decorative manner, whereas I simply end up with an ungainly result. I have many lilies, some over 10 feet in height. I thought I'd solved my problem when I discovered 6-foot-long rebar stakes, but at the first downpour, these giant lilies double over where the stakes ends, and the lily stalks are on their own. This happens in real gardens. New roses can become gawky, with some canes growing faster than other ones. Sometimes I cut the over-exuberant cane, leaving an obvious mark, while at other times I stake it. Am I the only gardener coping with adolescent roses? I suspect that garden stylists slip a planter into those bare areas of the perennial border that inevitably occur. Plants die. Gardeners constantly add and subtract sections of the border, and some plants fail to grow into their designated spaces. Notice those photographed borders. They are as unreal as those beautiful models portrayed in fashion magazines. Vegetable gardens are also unreal in this Neverland portrayed in garden magazines. Have you ever seen a tomato vine loaded with so many unblemished tomatoes? Squash villains simply don't exist in this world. The garlic heads plucked from the ground are huge. The lettuce never bolts. Weeds obviously do not exist. Now, one of my talents is that I'm a gifted weeder. I have a good eye for weeds and know which weeds want to exist in my garden. Between my eagle eye and the pine bark mulch, I can keep weeds to a minimum, yet even I will suddenly notice a tulip poplar seedling, a horrid nut sedge, or a pokeweed that I have overlooked. To garden is to weed, but ask yourself this. Would you know it from looking at those magazines? Therefore, I have decided to become an imaginary editor of an imaginary garden magazine. What would I do? I would choose a nice garden, as we really aren't interested in deserted gas station lots for this profile. I would ask the photographer to take pictures as the garden is, not as the garden we dream of. I would show the garden with all of its warts and warts. And then I would ask the gardener questions. How does this lavender have such a perfect shape? Why is this salvia so well behaved when mine sprawls? How much fertilizer do you use? Do you spray your roses? When you designed and planted this garden, what was your end purpose? Gardening is a hit and miss occupation. Some plants grow beautifully in my garden, while others, such as echinacea, give me horrendous headaches. I would ask my pretend gardeners how they can grow this native plant that eludes me. I can grow many roses, but Mrs. R. M. Finch simply eludes me. Why is this? I have no idea, but would love for my imaginary magazine to discover the answer. I would also want to hear of gardening mistakes. Without mistakes, how can one call oneself a true gardener? One of my great gardening mistakes was to plant Chasmanthium latifolium, a native plant sometimes called wild sea oats. This plant loved me, loved my soil, and seeded throughout the garden. However, when the seedlings appear, they are incredibly deep-rooted, making it almost impossible to remove. And it loves to grow in the middle of other plants, making it difficult to resort to chemical warfare. And I understand this is a warfare tactic many do not want to undertake. We learn from our mistakes. When a plant is described as exuberant, or soon you'll have enough to share with the neighborhood, I stay clear of that plant. So in my imaginary magazine, I'd ask the gardeners to describe their mistakes. I'd also make sure the recommendations for plants for specific parts of the country are accurate. A glaring example of a bad recommendation I just saw in a magazine was the recommendation of oriental lilies for North and South Carolina. Oriental lilies require temperate, moist summers if they are to bloom in August. They're wonderful for northern climes, but please plant the Orientpet lilies instead. Orientpet lilies, a hybrid of oriental and trumpet or Aurelian lilies, have all the desirable attributes of the oriental lilies, but can take the heat of our summers. Of course, I'm realistic enough to suspect my garden magazine would not sell. My daydream of a realistic garden is undoubtedly not shared by the public. So, perhaps the public is really getting what it wants. Models without hips, perfect strawberries, and perennial borders that blend into one another in their seemingly endless perfection. And this one is by Norman Winter, titled Milkweed, a Feast for More Than Just Monarchs. As we all strive to get our hands on every native milkweed for our states, and to the ultimate benefit of the monarch butterfly, I thought I might plug its use for the other guys. Your first thought might be I'm talking about the queen or soldier butterflies that are related to the monarch and also must have milkweeds as larval host plants. That's important, too. But I am speaking for the ability of the milkweed this time to be a nectar source for butterflies and hummingbirds. We love milkweeds because they are extraordinarily beautiful and intricate in their design, making them great plants for the landscape or the backyard wildlife habitat. Monarchs, queens, and soldier butterflies could not survive without them. If you stop and pay attention, however, you'll notice milkweeds are like the pollinator luncheon junction for an assortment of butterflies. Currently, in the hill country of Texas, not too far from San Marcos, Wimberley, and Dripping Springs, you'll find the antelope horn milkweed blooming everywhere. My brother, scouting for monarch and queen caterpillars like everyone else, was stunned to find 13 or more hairstreak butterflies and bees, too, hitting on the blossoms. I'm a hairstreak lover from way back, so this excites me about as much as monarchs. There were gray hairstreaks and numerous juniper hairstreaks. Speaking of hairstreaks, I have been treated once in Texas and once in Georgia to what I consider the most beautiful of all, the great purple hairstreak, appreciating the milkweed nectar. At the National Butterfly Center in Mission, Texas, I photographed the red-bordered pixie feeding on milkweed. Many enthusiasts have this butterfly at the top of their must-see bucket list. When you consider that hummingbirds and bees also frequent milkweeds, then there is surely the impetus for the nursery industry to maximize production of milkweeds, and the gardening public to open the pocketbook and purchase. Grow several of these, and your family will experience the whole life cycle of the butterfly. The landscape itself will also become a picture of the color. Plant them in full sun with fertile, well-drained soil, and you will find them to be virtually maintenance-free. Once you have yours planted, then the fun begins. Eggs will be laid. We call this ovipositing. These eggs will soon hatch into caterpillars that are as exotic in appearance as the butterflies. This is cause for family celebration. These caterpillars will eat, and they do so with a voracious appetite, lasting for around 2 weeks. You might think this stripping of the foliage would prove to be the demise of the plant, but in no time you will have more leaves and flowers. The caterpillars will disappear. They will be attaching themselves, head downward, and shedding their skin. Now it is time to go on the hunt for what is known as a chrysalis. Chrysalis is another name for pupa. You will find these hanging almost unnoticed on the underside of the leaf or a branch. I have also found them hanging from the wire of a nearby fence and even the eave of the house. The chrysalis looks green, but in reality it is clear, and colors become apparent as the monarch gets closer to emergence. This is the kind of fun that the kids or grandkids will enjoy, and the experience will make lasting memories. Adding to the memories will not just be watching the life cycle of monarch butterflies, but the graceful flight and feeding of an assortment of butterflies and hummingbirds, too. Next, from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter, Garden Prep for Tomatoes. Where you plant your tomatoes in the garden is important. Tomatoes need at least 6 to 8 hours of sun a day to produce well. Full sun is best. Tomato roots won't do well in soggy soil. A sunny, well-drained part of your garden is best. The best soil for tomatoes. Tomatoes like their soil pH around 6.0 to 6.8. Briefly, pH is a measure of soil acidity or alkalinity. On the pH scale, 7.0 is neutral, so the range which tomatoes prefer is slightly on the acid side.
That's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to Out in the Garden on the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, give us a call. Our telephone number is 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.